have the rules?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we do.
Do I need to open the work session?
Organizational meeting.
I'd like to open the organizational meeting on the rules. I would assume all of you folks have read them. We have to wait. I'm not sure if I have to wait to have the votes here or not, but in the meantime, do we have any, is there any discussion on the rules? Representative Estorado.
Actually, thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe in the back of the rules we have a section that talks about minority reports or the lack thereof or the fact that we cannot file a minority report. I have been adamantly against this on the floor. I'm adamantly against it here. I think that it actually goes to the core values that we hold in this country, that the minority party itself needs to have a say, or the minority group, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a party. It could be Republicans, Democrats, Independents, or whatever. But as long as we take that vehicle away from them, then that's a real tragedy. Myself, when I was in the majority and a member of the minority party, Representative Buckley and I wrote rules of the House that gave the minority party a chance to be heard at any given time, but for on behalf of their constituents. And yet within a year now, we've done away with that process, and I think it's a real tragedy for the state of Oregon as well as democracy itself. But I will, for the benefit of this committee, be voting to accept these rules just because there's no sense in being an obstructionist here. We just need to get on with our business.
Thank you, Representative. I share your sentiment. I wish things had been different. I think the late, I expressed this in another committee when we debated this issue, and I didn't speak to it on the floor. I think the length of the debate on the rule on the floor is an example of why we had to do something. I'm trying to justify what we did because we're limited in time. I have people out here right now. I'm hurrying along with legislation, telling them we got to go right now. I'm hurrying them along because of the brevity of this session. So I just wanted to make it clear. I share your sentiment and your concern that these are the rules and they're the rules we're going to live with. And anyone else have any more comments? And I need four votes here today, folks, so we can get moving. Any more comments on the rules?
Mr. Chair, I just want to point out that this is not relevant to the rules, but there was no chair at my place when I arrived here, so
oh.
I was prepared to stand through the whole hearing. So.
Well, I'm glad you got a chair, Representative.
Do we have a motion? Are we on a motion?
Well,
or do you need a motion?
I need a motion, yes.
I move adoption of the committee rules.
We have any discussion on the rules? We hope so.
I don't know.
Let me ask, is anybody going to be opposing the rules today? Representative Burley?
There's only four of us here.
I will be opposing the rules, as I did on the House floor, sir.
Okay. Do I have four votes for the rules here, or do I have to wait for Representative Holvey? Okay. Well, then we're going to sit here until Representative Holvey.
You need me to withdraw my motion?
No, so I'll just take a recess until we find Representative
Holvey.
Pardon me? Yes, please.
Where are the rules, by the way?
They're in the file there somewhere. Mr. Chair, why don't you just pull it out and amend it in reference to minority reports on the... What do you want to do? Well, we can't discuss it. We're not moving this today. And I don't think we're going to hear this and not move.
So we're just going to take this one?
Yes. I think you're posted for it. Wait and see. These aren't prepared.
Everybody's kind of all excited out there.
So.
But I mean, we've got them in.
I'm excited.
I know. You're always excited.
Me too.
Too excited.
It's kind of like, want to see me blink? stick around. It's going to take a while.
I can delete that. Will that be your vote? If I delete that from the rules and just change it to the references, the preliminary reports will be filled as reference to the House work. House rules.
The thing is, I know that happened in some committees. It does not change anything. Those rules are still, all the stages reflect what you've already adopted.
Right.
In House rules, I understand you.
God, Chris is not. So why would I vote for it here then?
But I understand.
Still in the
voting what?
It doesn't matter. It's still in effect.
That's right. I heard him on the phone that he sounded to.
He sounded better to me.
Well, I only heard him on a conference call, so I heard him. He sounded pretty good.
Yeah.
Have you called his office?
So can you call him at Colby's office? Do you use right outside? Or was he right outside?
He's outside.
He's out there.
And we, Representative Holby, we have a motion to adopt the rules. Do you have any comment? I think the rest of us have already commented.
No comment.
All right. Seeing no further comment, the clerk call the roll. Debbie? That's okay, huh? We're all trying to get squared away here in February. I don't think we've seen our shadow, so we don't know what the hell we're
doing. We may have six. We can have six more weeks of that.
No. No.
Representative Edwards?
Excuse me.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Representative Vice Chair Esquivel?
Aye.
Vice Chair Holby?
Aye.
And Chair Schaffer?
Aye. All right, rules are adopted. Thank you. All right, we're going to go. No, don't worry about it. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3636.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3636 directs the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to implement an incentive program for increased consumer sales of distilled liquors by agents that are operating state liquor stores. The bill specifies that the amount of the incentive be equal to the specified percentage of the amount of increased consumer sales. There is an emergency clause on the bill effective upon passage, but an operating date of July 1st, 2008. There's a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on the measure, and you, members, you have in front of you a -2 amendment. On the staff measure summary, it's a -1, but it's actually a -2 amendment. From the Oregon the Northwest Grocers Association. It clarifies that a holder of an Oregon Liquor Control Commission off-premise sales license may deliver wine, cider, or malt beverages sold pursuant to the license to retail consumers in Oregon without a direct shipper permit that is issued pursuant to ORS 471-282, which is otherwise known as House Bill 2171 from the 2007 session, which established the new direct shipper permit system.
Thank you. We're just going to have a public hearing period. We have a second time on this. Thank you. Okay, I'd like to call Mr. Farrow from OLCC and Marshall Koba, please. And I understand you gentlemen are going to just be, well, Mr. Farrow will be discussing both the incentive program and the amendment. And I believe, Marshall, you're just going to talk about the program, right?
That's correct. Good afternoon, Chair Schaffer and committee members. I'm Marshall Koba, representing the Associated Liquor Stores of Oregon. We thank you for this opportunity to discuss House Bill 3636. This concept has been before this committee twice before, and we reported on January 22nd that the OLCC Commission had voted unanimously in support of this plan at their December 2007 Commission meeting. This action by the commission was following an in-depth study done at the legislator's request following the 2005 session and a work group that solidified some of the issues in the fall of 2007. We have met with the co-chairs of the Ways and Means Committee, and both are supportive of the bill and are being sent to the Ways and Means Committee. The bill creates a process where liquor agents will be given a customer improvement plan to improve customer service, customer satisfaction, and to improve their stores and the overall shopping experience for their consumers. This bill has the potential to reward those agents who increase year-over-year sales. We thank you, Mr. Chair, for your generous time and attention over the last 2 months, and we look forward to your support today to move it to the Ways and Means Committee and then to pass the bill on the floor later in February. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, I'm Steve Farrow, director of the OLCC. And I'm going to have sort of dual here because we're going to talk about the customer service improvement plan and then about the second amendment of it.
Why don't we do the plan while Mr. Cove is up here, okay, and then we'll move on to the amendment. I'll ask Mr. Oxley to come up.
Okay, Mr. Chair. First, the premise of the incentive plan was to go ahead and create an environment where agents, which are contractors, they're small independent businessmen, would take prudent risk in improving their stores, their locations, whatever it may be with regards to the customer shopping convenience and improvement. And by taking that risk, provide better customer service. In taking that risk, I think the commission clearly felt in terms of the study and what came out of the study was that there would be a way to go ahead and reward those agents that take that risk and step forward and do the right things to meet the customer service needs. For instance, if the store is three streets back from the main road and it's small, it is not very convenient for a lot of customers to come to, and they may not like going to that particular area of town. But if they relocate to the main part of the town, it may be extremely expensive. So there's a cost involved in that process. So there's a risk. The state doesn't assume that risk. That falls on the small business owner. So as that small business owner, in order to improve the customer experience and provide that kind of level of customer service that the state wants, we encourage them to go ahead and constantly be improving their stores, whether it's shelving, lighting, locations, building conditions, whatever it is. And as they move forward to do some of those things, obviously they take a risk. And I think the premise of this incentive plan, as it started out being called, but really it's a customer service improvement plan, it will reward those agents that move to a better location to provide that convenience. It will reward those agents that go ahead and improve those stores. So when you go in that store, the retail shopping experience is everything you want it to be, everything that we want it to be, everything that we expect it to be. So the premise is, as they take this risk, the old reward mechanism was sort of a lower rate pay, which would take a long time to recover. If they're going to take this risk, as any prudent business person, there should be a chance to return that risk, those risk dollars, at a faster rate. And that's really what we're looking to do with this incentive plan. The commission has endorsed it. It sees it as a way to go ahead and encourage those agents who may be on the border of making some of these changes to provide the monetary return that says they'll take the risk and move forward and create that retail shopping experience that the state wants. And that really pretty much sums it up. It's really directed at it's not throwing money at agents. It's about saying if you do the right things to take care of the customers that are out there that want to buy distilled spirits, then if you do those right things, you'll have a chance to go ahead and get your money back a little faster.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
May I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Steve, you know, a couple things you said here. If you do the right thing, then you'll get rewarded. This is a customer service improvement plan. But when I read this, I'm asking myself, where in this bill does it say if you do the right thing? Where in this bill does it say that if this increased sales comes from an improved store location or an improved facility, then you will get this return on your investment? The way I read this is if I can increase my sales 10%, I just get more money. Help me. I mean, you're telling me one thing, but I'm not quite seeing that in the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, you're right. The bill is bare bones in the way that it sets about what the reward is. It is not constructed with all the nuances. I think in reflecting upon the bill that we would probably want to have in there that would have showed how what we have seen is that
there is increased sales that take place, even if you don't move the store, even if you don't do anything. But that's pretty marginal in many cases. What we have seen is when the stores are improved, when they're relocated, when they go to those areas that create the convenience, when they create the ambiance of when you walk in that store, it's a really great shopping experience. That's where we have seen the major moves and the major increases in sales. So your point's well taken that within the body of the bill itself, it does not spell out some of those nuances, but certainly we have seen in most cases that real growth takes place when the right things, so to speak, are done in terms of improving the stores, the locations, et cetera.
Follow up. Is there any way that we could put some language in here that said that somehow made that connection? You know, that these increased sales, this whole incentive plan is to help. I mean, we're talking capital investments here. Mm-hmm. Is there any way that we can make that link clear in the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, if that's what the committee chooses to do or that's what they want to do, I think there are ways to go ahead and connect that, because obviously if you move from one location three streets off the main road and move up to the main road, you're going to show an increase in terms of what the cost of the rent for that building is. If you're going to put in new shelving within that store, you're going to be able to see what the cost of that shelving is. So there are some ways to link it. I understand where you're driving this. So if you just sit back and you do nothing, and it sort of falls in your lap because you get increased sales, you get extra money. No doubt about it, there is a potential. If you just sit there and do nothing, what we have seen, that doesn't happen. Could it happen? Yes, it could happen. If we want to go ahead and strengthen the language, it somehow ties it to show that if you spend a minimum of X, then you can go ahead and get the 10% or 15% depending upon what the sales are. We could certainly try to do that. It's just that it gets oftentimes subjective in terms of, even if they move to a new location, is that the 100% of why they got the increase? I don't think any of us can say for sure. So one of the things that we wanted to try and get away from was a subjective view of the decisions that an independent businessman makes. For instance, if one of the store owners said, I'm three streets off the main road. There's a great store right on the main road. It's 1,500 square feet rather than 600 square feet. It's got the windows. It's got new shelving. It's got all those things that customers really like to see. I'm going to take that risk and move up there. That's the risk that he assumes. The state assumes no risk on that. Right. So the agent assumes all that risk. So the question is, how do you link? So if it goes up 15% and it costs $1,000 more a month, how do you link those two things together gets difficult. That's why we were looking at no subjective way. If you whatever the increases are, what we have found have been directly correlated to improvements in the store. For instance, if they add another 10 feet of shelving, they bring in another 50 different type of products, then more people will go ahead and buy some of those different products. So the difficult part is how and what relationship you link whatever they take risk with to the return. Some of them, just by moving or creating some ambience in their store, may get a 10% increase. So does that mean because they did that, they shouldn't get 10%, they should only get 5%? It gets muddy. But we could certainly try and do something like that if it meant helping the incentive plan.
I imagine, I mean, what every store and every local market is different from another local market, and the changes needed to increase that may be one group of changes at store A or another different group of changes at store X. So if you start drawing out this X, Y, and Z, well, some stores it might help, some stores it might. But I would like, if this does become the law, I'd be interested in following up, finding out exactly when you implement the plan, the program, exactly what the actual language of what you're asking of these folks. I mean, you're going to implement a plan, it must be on paper somewhere, a program. So I think that's what the good representative is trying to get at, too.
Well, if I may, one more time, Mr. Chair, thank you. First a question, then just a comment to kind of close at this point for me. Would this necessarily result in additional stores in Oregon, or would this just, I mean, result in moving stores, as you put it, improving the customer service? would we end up with more retail stores under this plan, or just the same stores relocated to a better location, better facility?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, you wouldn't necessarily end up with more stores. The basis for a new store is based upon the population growth and based upon a number of the demographic factors that we've sort of put together. So if there's a store in a town of 5,000, even if he moved the store, no matter what, there probably is not a need for a second store within that city or that town. There will always be times when, even though a store may have moved to a better location, the growth in that area has become so substantial that from a customer service standpoint, we say, yep, we need a second store in that area. So it would not, this particular plan does not limit the expansion of stores, but that's sort of based upon different issues, so to speak. This really at its heart and soul is about trying to go ahead and recognize that as small independent businesses, there's great risk to do the things that we believe are appropriate for the retail marketplace. And in trying to ensure that they are rewarded in a way that continues that process is really, I think, where we're trying to go with this.
Okay, Al.
Thank you. Just so I keep this clear, though, a specific improvement that may help a store in Salem may not, that same improvement or action taken in another community may not help them. So that's why you're trying to stay away from the subject of dialed in this or this, and you get on.
Mr. Chair, you bring up a great point. Over in Pendleton, you may be able to make one improvement, which may not work in Burns, which may not work in Bend, which may not work in Portland. So once you get into the subjectivity of trying to link all those nuances, culturally or whatever, it gets to be pretty difficult.
Right. Any more questions? Representative Rosenbaum?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I guess this does follow in the heels of Representative Burley's question. I understand there are a lot of intentions that aren't quite expressed in this bill, but what I'm not quite understanding, it seems like there's no linkage, I guess, to the improvements and the increased sales. And my question is really, so if sales increase for other reasons, just because more people are moving into the state, that would, I would think, cause sales to increase just because more people are shopping at these stores. Is there some way that this bill can ensure that we're not just rewarding increased sales just by sheer volume increases because the population increases?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, excellent question. Trying to link those two together is and would be a pretty interesting task, because if there's growth in one area, it does not necessarily mean that the growth of those individuals moving within that area, that they like distilled spirits. They may prefer beer and wine. So you may not have growth there. By the same token, within one area itself, if they move to another location, just by the convenience of that location, you may have more people see the store and may want to stop into the store. So the ability to say, if there's whatever, I know where you're going, which is if there's imminent growth, you don't reward for imminent growth. You reward based upon the changes that you make to enhance that customer experience. But if you make the changes to that store, even though the growth is taking place, I don't know how to de-link the two. So if the store improves itself, even though there's growth in the area, how do you tell which is between the growth and which is because it's a better store? For instance, if the area grows by a set percentage, but once again, because of the move, all the growth, those folks like wine, but because of the move, the residents of that locale that were there before tend to turn more toward distilled spirits. I don't know how you decouple those two.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure that was quite answering my question, because to me it's only logical that if you've got, you know, 3.5 million people and the population increases to 4 million, among that extra 500,000, some of those people are going to drink hard liquor, and so they're not all going to be beer and wine drinkers. Maybe people think that people move here just for the wine industry and microbrews, but I think we've got sort of an eclectic population that moves here. I guess the other probably more fundamental objection, I don't know if we're getting testimony from the Governor's Commission on DUII. We have a written document in our file now from the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII that really raises a fundamental objection, which is just that we should find some other way to help store owners improve their stores, but that they're concerned that we're somehow encouraging people to drink more. And I was just curious if you had, and then they link that to the obvious health and safety consequences of alcohol consumption. Do you have a response to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, certainly another alternative is to go ahead and say, don't link it to increase in sales. Just go ahead and take a percentage, and across the board you give a percentage raise, and then whatever that is, that's what everybody gets regardless of how sales go. That's certainly one thing that can take place. But once again, it's one of those things where what we were looking to do is for the risk that was taken to improve the stores, then there would be a direct correlation, or more of a direct correlation of payback based upon taking some of that risk by moving to another location. It doesn't diminish the fact that if that's the preferred alternative for the committee, straight across the board, Grace, I think the commission is interested in seeing all the agents properly rewarded.
I think there's a little issue with giving more money to the agents without growing the pie, though, just a little one. So somebody's going to get pinched. Are we going to take that money out of services, or are we going to take it out of the people that provide them with the product? And you know what? I don't really think I want to have that battle. So any further questions?
Thank you.
Kevin? Representative, thank you, Cameron.
That's okay. It's my punishment.
Yeah, right.
But I was here on time, Mr. Chair.
And you're a fine American, sir.
I did not delay it. I wanted to maybe just go back, because we had testimony, and somebody can just clarify. I want to make sure in my mind we had testimony about, I think, 3 points that we needed to really clarify. And there is another bill sitting out there about the limited, unlimited function. And when I heard it in testimony in our previous hearing, it was real clear to me that that was the main priority, was to make sure that when I, as an OLCC agent or as a contractor, signed up to say this was going to be my commission, and you talk about making an investment, I'm signing up to make this investment, and I'm basically saying this is what I'm going to get paid on this investment. And then to have a limitation that says, oh, by the way, you're not going to get that payment for your services. We're going to change the payment during the middle of the game. That, to me, is a first priority that we should be dealing with to protect our OLCC agents and these guys gals that are coming to the plate and saying, I'm going to invest money. The second thing was an increase in the base, and you know, I know the chair doesn't want to get into that, and I certainly do, because if it's truly that we're not compensating people enough for the core work they're already doing, I think we're kidding ourselves in trying to do that. And I think there's a couple issues here. You know, one is, what's our constitution say, and you know, about the OLCC and our role, and if we're pushing these increases, 20% incentive for for 15% or more above, and I assume that's above the 8.5% that I'm already going to earn on that sale. So now I'm going to pay somebody 28% of. Am I right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm way up here, and I'm looking at that as going, wow, I got to get up there, because that's some big dollars. The third thing that. One of the testimonies that we had in our last committee, or one of our committees, was from one of the owners, and he talked about, and I remember asking this question, he talked about an investment that he made of $30,000 in his store and interior and computer system, and in no way did the increase of $200,000 in sale that resulted in a $15,000 commission return that year cover the original investment of $30,000. Well, as a business person, I think he was probably, and maybe somebody can clarify this for me, you're going to amortize that investment, not in just 1 year, but over a period of whatever your lease is or whatever those investments are. Some of that obviously is probably in his people, and that's going to come up every year, so it's not going to be amortized. But purely, that's a 50% return, and if I got that every year, that's, I'd like to invest in that kind of business myself, because in a couple of years it's 100% paid for, and as I increase sales. So I guess I'm a little bit concerned that we're throwing this big, huge target out there to go out and sell a lot more alcohol to get that money when I heard there were some deeper concerns that we should be dealing with first, and I'm going to kind of go over there with my colleague about, is this really the direction that we should be going versus expanding the base? And I'll just, I didn't ask a question, I'm just going to make my statements there.
Well, as far as us kidding ourselves around your representative, I think that happens on quite a few issues. But on the limited or non-limited payment, I don't think the Ways and Means Committee was really interested in dealing with that subject matter in February. But I think you're right. We do need to address that issue. So yeah, that's a simple response from me. Any further questions, Representative?
Well, Mr. Yeah, I wanted to kind of have a little closing comment here, too, because as Representative Cameron said, that there were three things, the base rate, the commission, which is a limited funds issue, and now this incentive plan. You know, I absolutely understand and appreciate, because I speak to some of the agents in Bend about this. I mean, I don't know the business. They do. So I ask them, what do you guys think about this? So I understand this issue about helping them with these, what I consider to be capital investments. But I'm having a little bit of trouble with the bill as it's drafted right now, and making that connection that's really what it's trying to do. So I just want to leave you with that you're going to have to convince me that.
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the thing that we're avoiding in this conversation is a couple things. One is we're not talking about the people that do nothing that's going to get more money. We're not talking about that. So I'm pretty straightforward to the point. The other thing we aren't talking about is what kind of an impact is this going to have with our OLCC revenue into the general fund? I see nothing here that tells me either. I would at least like to see that.
Well, any further questions? Well, before, I think the agents and the department have some work to do if we're going to pass this bill. We're not going to move it out today. But so I'm just going to move on to the amendment, unless you folks have any more comments. Yes, Representative.
I would like to add one more thing to that, though, as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that is, folks, we are in this business. I believe that DUIs have dropped over the last 10 years, I think. I haven't anything to substantiate that, but I believe it has. For our ratio of our population. I think that's what I was reading here recently, and I hope that is, in fact, the case. But this is the business we're in. We as a state have chosen to be in this business.
Okay, Mr. Koba.
Mr. Chair, if I could just make a final comment here. I think the expectations of the OLCC have increased significantly over the last several years of agents. And you know, if you want to go back to a planning document, there was a document created and probably printed in 1999, but it's called the Year 2000 and Beyond Manual. It talks about better stores, better locations, better lighting, better parking. There has been polling done after that study, which talks about the shopping experience and how we need to be more attractive for the female shopper, and how a lot of these stores are, you know, a lot of people don't want to go into them. So, you know, this issue is not, if you look at 3636 as a standalone bill without an appreciation for the last 6-8 years of discussion, I mean, it's 2008 and that issue came out in the year 2000, it's it could be maybe a little stark. But if you look at it in an understanding that we've had some discussion, and I said this at the first hearing that we had back in December, this issue, and I really appreciate this discussion. This is a great discussion. But 99.9% of this discussion, if not 100% of this discussion prior to coming to this committee in December, was in the Ways and Means Committee, and usually in a subcommittee. And so we're raising a lot of good questions here that have not necessarily been discussed there. So the incentive plan, the three-tiered, which I called it in December, the Asian Compensation Modernization Act of 2008 was a three-tiered plan. And we were thrilled that the commission acted upon that at the December meeting. And you got to understand, the commission hasn't acted on that for a long, long time. And to come out of there with the commission approval unanimously of moving from 8.88 to 9.5, an incentive plan, and to go to the non-limited was significant for us. And there's been a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to get to this point. And I think that the study that was funded, and we spent $450,000 on a study coming out of the 05 session, and the question there really was, are agents fairly compensated? So that's what this is coming to you, and that's what 3636 is about, is what the commission approved. We look forward to working with the committee. We look forward to working with the agency and coming back to you with if this needs to be improved. But the premise of the study and the premise of our discussion for a number of years has been that it's difficult for us to do the things that the commission expects us to do. I mean, we are the policemen before. You know, we're selling $800-some million of this stuff, and we are the conduit to the public. And we're hiring a lot of low-wage people, and we're not paying them any benefits, and they're getting hired, and they're looking for another opportunity. This money is going to go back into the system and back into maintaining the future viability of the system. And I want to leave you with that this is part of that, and it's important that, you know, we've been working on it, and if we'd love to come out of the 08 session here in the next 25 days with a plan.
And before you go sit down, Marshall, I just want to say, I mean, I think a lot of there's a psychological hump people have to get over. We're looking at a business plan here. We're not going to solve alcohol abuse, drunk driving, and all the bad things that come along with the abuse of alcohol. But we're looking at a business plan and a business that we take great advantage of. And people are out there generating a whole buckets full of money for us to spend here. And I think we are kidding ourselves when we do not look at it as a business. Now, all the other things need to be addressed, too. If people want to talk about more money for treatment, I'm ready to spend more money on treatment. But I think it's hard to separate it, and I think what I've done in my mind is to separate all those other issues and just look at this as a business plan. And I think getting more money to the agents and doing all the things that have been talked about here, we have to find the easiest, simplest way to get there from here. And I think this is probably going to be it, because a lot of the other options we've looked at hit a lot of road bumps, a lot of bumps in the road. So we got to move on. I appreciate you coming, Marshall. I'm going to call up your Mrs. Vandell. I want to call Gary Oxley and Paul Romaine. You may want to stay up here, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. And I think before you go, Marshall, you and the agents, if you're going to leave and not listen to the amendment, where time is of the essence, you all need to do your work. And next Tuesday, we're going to be done here with House bills. So, all right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I make one comment?
Yes, sir.
I just want to go ahead and certainly recognize Representative Burley and Representative Rosenbaum's comment about the wording within the bill. It certainly, because it is very stark and lean, it does make it difficult for a lot of folks to be able to read into all the nuances that we have. So we certainly recognize that, and we're happy to work with anybody to go ahead and clear that up.
All right, thank you. Now we're going to hear the amendment that I think needs amended. And Gary, if you want to just go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, Gary Oxley, Oxley & Associates, appearing before you this afternoon on behalf of Safeway and Safeway's subsidiary company, Safeway.com. Let me make two points very quickly. Number one, we have no position on House Bill 3636 other than it has a relating clause, and regardless of what happens to 3636, I am proposing an amendment that we hope adds additional purpose to the bill. Number two, very rarely, probably once every decade, my colleague Paul Romaine and I actually agree on something, and we are here together this afternoon to agree on the amendment that you have before you. So, as professional staff pointed out earlier, what we are trying to do here is correct, really, some unintended consequences of House Bill 2171, and we are asking for nothing more nothing more than what we had prior to January 1st of this year. So I want to make that very clear, because there's some misinformation going around the building as to what the intent of this amendment is. And if I may, what we are trying to do is get back to where we were. Prior to January 1st of this year, Safeway.com would receive an order from a consumer, and that consumer would buy product from us, to and including beer and wine. And they may have wanted that beer and wine sent to a church for a wedding, which we would deliver to, or sent to a union hall for a party, which we would deliver to. And we had the right to do that. And it was unlimited in terms of volume. And we have very strict rules that our drivers follow. They are far stricter than walking into our brick-and-mortar store and buying any amount or volume of alcohol that you choose to buy. So we are very, very careful, very serious, and we follow a substantial number of rules when we do home delivery. So what happened as a result of House Bill 2171 was the unintended consequence that we came under the guise of limiting us to delivering only two cases of wine per month to an individual. Under current statute today, we can still deliver any quantity of beer, but we were limited under the 2171 to two cases per month to an individual of wine. We simply want to correct that, and that's what the intent and purpose of this amendment is. And Mr. Chair, if you would allow me, I would ask Mr. Romaine to follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Paul Romaine, members of the committee. I'm Paul Romaine. I'm representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association, and it is a pleasure to be up here with Mr. Oxley, speaking with him. Here's the simple situation. Prior to what's called the Granholm case, decided by the Supreme Court a couple of years ago, everybody assumed you could treat in-state alcohol differently than you treat out-of-state alcohol under the 21st Amendment. In a 5-4 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court, about 2.5 years ago, decided that at least at the producer level, and that's very important, and at least for wine, you had to treat in-state and out-of-state the same. What that meant is, on direct shipping, if you allowed your in-state winery to ship directly their homegrown product to a consumer, you had to allow the out-of-state winery to do the same thing. So basically what happened was 2171 was in response to that. How do you set up a system that allows for permits to allow in-state wineries and out-of-state wineries to ship? Well, under our old law, which was a reciprocal law, in other words, we only offered that privilege to states that had, in effect, agreed to let our wineries and retailers ship in, we allowed retailer shipping. By the way, the reciprocal law covered basically every relevant state. There is really nobody who orders wine from wineries in Kansas. But, I mean, you can, but I don't know why you would. The Thompson Seedless makes a wonderful wine, actually. So what happened was we were trying to solve the problem, because under Granholm, really, the reciprocal statutes were now probably unconstitutional. Because Oregon always allowed retailers to do shipping into the state under reciprocal law, we decided under 2171, we being you, I use the royal we, that somehow we had to let retailers do it too. So you kept the same case limit, the two cases. What you said was everybody can get a permit, basically, to do the shipping, two cases a month. What we didn't think about when it was being done is the consequence on the in-state retailer who is, like Safeway.com, selling to the party or the wedding or the union hall or whatever other function might be going on. What I believe under Granholm, what Granholm applies is it applies really only to the producer level. It doesn't apply to retail. Now, there is some litigation that's going on that's a little contrary to that, and there's some litigation that's going on that supports my position. In New York, a federal court has said it doesn't apply to retail. You can treat your in-state retailers differently than out-of-state. A Texas court just recently said, no, you can't, but it was the stupidest decision you've ever read because they require the out-of-state retailer who's shipping into Texas to buy from a Texas wholesaler. Not a real practical decision. So we believe that's an error. But talking with the retailers, what they're willing to do is run the risk that, and basically say on the record that if for any reason it's found that the Granholm case really does apply at retail and you can't discriminate in-state versus out-of-state, that the provision that we've placed into this amendment would be severed. In other words, it would go away. So you'd go back to the two-case limit for everybody. So they weren't willing to run that risk. The thing about in-state shipping that's different than out-of-state shipping at the retail level is it's already gone through the whole system. Taxes have been paid. You've got the retailer here ready, subject to your jurisdiction. There is no real worry about it, and that's why you allowed it in the past. You really didn't have a problem with Safeway.com or Safeway or Fred Meyer or 7-Eleven or anybody else out there, in effect, doing this. There is no quantity limit on the amount that can be purchased. And we are working right now with the OLCC on delivery rules that hopefully will be able to, through their rulemaking power, will limit deliveries to fraternity houses, things like that, where we have abuse. This does nothing to change that. We're still working with them on those kind of rules that we all want. But all we're asking with this amendment, it's very simple. It doesn't amend, except for, it doesn't amend the shipper permit statute. That's Section 2. It just has the sort of except for this other little wrinkle we're putting in. It amends the license itself, in other words, the off-premise license that Safeway and other retailers have, and it just says that they can sell wine or cider, they can deliver wine or cider that's sold to their retailer customers. That's the exact same thing that they could do prior to the implementation of 2171. It doesn't solve everybody's problem. Wineries, you will never be able to do that with wineries. Because you allow out-of-state wineries to ship two cases, an in-state winery, because of the Granholm case, is going to be limited to two cases. But all the out-of-state wineries and in-state wineries, generally speaking, sell through our Oregon retailers. And no, this is not self-service on our part. Because they're self-serving on our part, because they don't have to go through us. They can go directly to a retailer. They don't have to sell through a distributor. This is not our way of cornering a market. It's simply a way for them to get back to where they were. Thank you.
Mr. Carroll?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, committee members, before I ask Donna Vandal to go ahead and go over some of our concerns. We too recognize that this is a special occasion when these two gentlemen are actually sitting at the table agreeing on something. And I would sort of launch into this saying that our primary purpose for commenting on this is we want to raise concerns. Before this meeting actually took place, there was sort of a quick meeting in the hall, and I think there may be some interpretation issues on what we interpret and what somebody else sees. So our purpose here is to raise issues that we think are pertinent for the committee to understand and hear. And with that, will allow us to go ahead and make sure that whatever comes out of this, that it is fair, equitable, defendable for the future, and meets the citizens' needs. So I'm going to ask Donna to go ahead and sort of talk about it.
Yes, Chair Schaffler and committee members, I'd just like to outline a couple of the concerns that the OLCC sees in these amendments with regard to the retail groceries retailers, off-premises retailers. The primary one is that the amendments would upset the balanced structure that the legislature created in the last session when it passed a comprehensive wine direct shipper bill. And it does this by making an exception from all of the requirements and safeguards in the direct shipper law for the Oregon licensed retailers only, which is the grocery stores and convenience stores. Wineries and out-of-state entities would continue to be subject to the direct shipper law, but the in-state retailers would not. We do feel that there are some public safety concerns by allowing the unlimited quantities of wine or cider to be delivered by retailers directly to Oregon consumers. The amendments also raise public safety concerns by eliminating, again, only for retailers, the safeguards in the direct wine shipper law, including those that require a person who delivers wine or cider to verify the age of the person receiving the delivery, to label the delivery container that it contains alcohol and may not be delivered to anyone under age 21, to use only an approved carrier to make the deliveries, to verify that the recipient is not visibly intoxicated, etc. These requirements, I think, were a key component of the legislation that was passed in the last session and helped to ensure that alcohol is not delivered to minors. In addition, the amendments create inequity between the Oregon retailers and the Oregon wineries. The wineries continue to be subject to the direct shipper law, including the limitation on 2 cases per month for delivery to consumers, while the retailers could deliver unlimited quantities. The amendments also create inequity between in-state retailers and out-of-state retailers, who also would remain subject to the current law and the limit of 2 cases per month. We're concerned that these inequities could lead to litigation against the state, particularly by the out-of-state entities, based on the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the Granholm case that Paul had alluded to. And finally, we're concerned that if the inequities created by these amendments were to be challenged by out-of-state retailers, then the state would stand to lose substantial privilege tax revenues as a result of the shipment of unlimited quantities of wine and cider into the state by out-of-state retailers and the associated difficulty in collecting privilege tax on shipments to consumers from outside the state. Thank you.
Before we passed the bill last year, I could get on Safeway.com and get an unlimited amount of beer and wine sent to my house. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And how many years did we do that? How many years was that in place?
We do have rules that govern the shipment and required that that come to you not the same day but the next day, and that they did have to have certain constraints in place, but there was not a quantity limitation.
How many years, Mr. Chair? How many years was that in place?
I'm not sure how long we had our delivery.
Mr. Oxley,
quite a while.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe we've had Safeway.com in effect in Oregon for approximately 6 years without any incidents.
In that 6 years, we have not been sued or anything, and we haven't lost.
Well, that was prior
things
to Granholm.
Things did not come to the right.
True. That was prior to the Granholm. I think Granholm may have changed the rules.
And I can go down to my truck and look at Safeway or Freddy's or any place, and I can literally load that truck up with as much beer and wine as I want, as long as I'm 21 years old and I am not visibly intoxicated. Is that correct? Okay, good. Representative Burley.
Mr. Chair, I want to just kind of qualify your question a little bit, if I could, because the chair asked, you know, previously we could get as much of this shipped as we wanted to, and the qualifier is from an in-state or out-of-state retailer. Is that correct?
No.
Okay, so help elaborate on that. Help us. So in the past, there was a distinction between in-state and out-of-state. That's what led to this lawsuit. That's what led to, what was it, 2171 or whatever the bill was last session?
Mm-hmm. To equalize.
Okay. So I guess I'm having the difficulty I'm having here is trying to understand why we didn't reach that equilibrium that we thought we did. And all right, do you have written testimony, by the way?
We just pulled this together this morning, so we do have notes. I don't know that it's in the form of the written testimony, but we can provide it to the committee.
I'd like that because you had a lot of points,
that.
And I couldn't write that fast.
Mm-hmm.
I know
we
Mr. Romaine can, but I can't. So help me understand. I want to go back, Gary and Paul, to your comments. I mean, help me understand why do we have this imbalance that we thought we achieved last session?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, what we were trying to solve last year was simply the, in effect, winery direct shipping issue. And it had a tangential bit about retailer shipping. But if what you always had a limit on the amount that an out-of-state retailer could ship into the state. That was always 2 cases per month. That was always, ever since you passed the reciprocal law, that's been the limit. Prior to that time, a retailer couldn't ship anything into the state, period. You've never had, since the end of Prohibition, a limit on the amount that Safeway could sell in-state to an in-state customer. That's never been in your law. The reason you don't do it from a policy perspective is you have them right here. If they mess up and sell to the wrong person, they're easy to punish. an out-of-state person is totally different. Alcohol can be a dangerous product if abused, and so you want to make sure you have the possibility of abuse at least covered. So that's why you've made the distinction. 2171 went into a, you know, it tried to solve the problem and be fair to everybody, and it just, for whatever reason, the folks involved with it just missed the, or assumed that, it didn't apply to the sales from a Safeway, a Fred Meyer, Roth's, or any place else that where somebody comes walking in the door. But basically, under the what's happening here is if I walk into Safeway and I'm physically present in Safeway and I say I want 6 cases of Chateau Screwtop and I buy it right there and I go back to my house. Now, I would never buy that stuff. You know me better than that. But if I did and I came back to the house and I said I want you to send it to me, under the interpretation right now, they couldn't do that. Now, what we're saying is it's worth the risk. I understand where the OLCC is coming from. They don't want to get involved in litigation, and we do understand that. The reason that you probably will never have litigation over this is what we are also saying to you is that the remedy, which you will put on the record, is that you sever the ability for Safeway and the in-state people to ship unlimited quantities. So if you're an out-of-state retailer, there's no incentive whatsoever to sue under this, because the remedy is simply to stop the in-state retailer from doing any shipping. It will not get you the ability to sell anymore. Plus, out-of-state wineries and probably in-state wineries will benefit from this, because they can sell and do sell through Safeway. Yes, it doesn't solve the winery problem. It doesn't give your in-state winery the ability to ship more than 2 cases, but you can't do that anymore under Granholm unless you raise the ability of the out-of-state winery to do unlimited shipment, and you don't want to go there. Thank you.
Any further questions?
Just a clarification, I think, because you brought it up, Mr. Chair. So prior to us passing the bill, Safeway was selling more than 2 cases online of wine or beer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, committee members, as I led off, I just want to make sure that you understood our concerns. We're not jumping up and down here, and I think there's a matter of interpretation here. Certainly one of our major concerns is we felt in the direct shipper bill that it clearly expressed the controls in the delivery process to make sure that minors did not get the products. That is a major concern for us. If the committee chooses to go ahead and continue or move and make it unlimited, we do have concerns that that does pose a public safety risk because there's a volume. Notwithstanding the fact that it was done in the past, the commission took a position that 2 cases were more appropriate. So I think once again, it's a matter of we have some long-term concerns with the possible outcomes. We understand where the gentlemen are coming from, and perhaps there is some misunderstanding in terms of interpretation, but we certainly feel these are concerns that need to be closely examined.
Well, I mean, we're all concerned. I mean, I got a 14-year-old daughter. I don't want her or her little mates getting a hold of anything. And we don't want the beer and wine delivered to people that don't use it appropriately. I just, you know, when I look at both of these concepts we've discussed here today, on the one hand, I think we rightfully want to increase the volume of sales to help the agents make more money. And here we're saying, well, we better be careful not to increase the volume of sales. I mean, you all know where I'm at on this, so it's no secret, but I do appreciate you expressing your concerns. I share those concerns. But, Mr. Oxley, you look like you have something to say.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we, too, support regulated delivery requirements, and I want to make that perfectly clear. We will work with the agency on rules to do that. We have standard forms that we make our drivers fill out when they arrive at the location. You have to check the ID. You have to put the driver's license number in here. The person receiving it has to sign for it. The wine and beer is shipped in a separate container so that there's not a mistake. It's not missed when the grocery bags are put on the step. There are cautions in place, and over the past 6 years that we've been involved in Safeway.com deliveries, we have not had an incident related to delivering to a minor.
No good work, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Oxley, thank you, and I appreciate that. Is that something that you are required to do by the OLCC, or is that something that you doing internally?
Yes, when we initially set out to take the Safeway.com program on, that was something that we had negotiated with the OLCC, and it is, I believe, it is in rule. Yes.
Sometimes, but tricky.
So we are very supportive of that, adding more to the rule if necessary to ensure that alcoholic products are not delivered to anyone under the age of 21 years old.
Mr. Chair, committee members, one thing that, and we had discussed that very issue, one thing that would be, we feel would be appropriate is have in the bill itself that the shipping delivery rules would be covered by OLCC rules. So that definitely means we can defer to those rules.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we would agree.
Well, great. And I have one more person going to testify on this. We have a very limited timeline, folks. And what we don't get done, we don't get done. So that's true for everything we hear here. So go do good work and come back with a product we can all.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. I'm going to call up Andy Shaw, please. Would anyone else like to testify on this bill today? All right, go ahead, Mr. Shaw.
Andy Shaw with the League of Oregon Cities. I actually wanted to talk to the base bill, not the amendments.
Yes, please. I forgive me. I wish I had known that. I would have called you.
It's all right. Cities, counties, and the state all get a share of liquor revenues, and our concern with the base bill as it's crafted is that it creates incentives that could end up just being bonus payments to people who don't change anything or add store capacity or take any of the risks that were discussed earlier. We conducted a study last year that looked at the amount of revenue cities obtain and examined alcohol-related public safety efforts, so things that are directly related to the consumption of alcohol, such as DUIs, minors in possession, and so on, and found that cities don't get compensated to the amount they spend money on those activities through liquor revenues. So any program that impacts the flow of revenues to cities is of concern to us. We understand from the Liquor Commission that the incentive program, as it's crafted, would take $4 million out of the funds that are distributed to the state cities and counties. That's about a $1.4 million hit to city revenues in the future. And we would want to see any incentive program be clearly linked to some kind of investment or capacity expansion or risk-taking on the part of the agents, not simply be an automatic bonus. The way the bill is crafted now, with normal growth, almost every agent would get a 5% bonus or incentive because liquor sales have been growing every year, which on the flip side means that our need to provide public safety services where liquor is consumed inappropriately is increasing as well. And so our public safety costs are increasing. If this money is taken away without real sales increase, then we're not getting additional revenues to address those events. So we appreciate you listening to our testimony.
Any questions? Mr. Shaw, thank you very much. If there's no further testimony on this bill, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3636, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3632.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3632 exempts persons who receive nothing more than a ski pass for volunteering either with or ski patrol or a ski area program activity sponsored by a ski area operator or a nonprofit corporation or organization from minimum wage standards, mandatory workers' compensation coverage, and unemployment compensation taxation requirements. There's an emergency clause on the measure effective on passage, and there's a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee.
Do you have a sign-up sheet?
I'm getting it right now, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, while you're getting the sign-up, if I may make a few comments, and I wish some of our other committee members were here to hear this, but first of all, I want...
The ones that matter are here, Representative.
Yes, that's... Well, the ones that had some real serious concerns last time are not here. But I wanted to first of all say, Mr. Chair, that I very, very, very much appreciate all of the departments that have cooperated on this, Employment, SAFE, BOLI, all they have all worked very hard at trying to come to closure on this.
What you're going to hear, I believe, with some of the testimony is that we're not quite there yet. So I'll leave the details to the witnesses, but I really do want to appreciate, express my appreciation to the departments for the help that they've been doing on this.
Thank you. Yes.
All right, I'd like to call Mr. Jeff Eager up first. I believe you have going to shed light on why we're here. Thank you.
You mind if I bring a couple of folks up with me?
No, but we, you know, we're running late, so let's just try and keep it tight and concise and to the point. Please. It's.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jeff Eager. I represent Mount Bachelor Sports Education Foundation and Mount Bachelor Incorporated. I won't go into too much of the background of this because the committee members already heard about this on January 22nd. I'm here to answer any questions you might have, and I'll also provide you with a brief update with regard to the substantial changes in the bill language between January 22nd and today's date. There should be, hopefully being distributed to you, a document that is called Amendment to HB 3632. And that is a one-page document that incorporates the changes that we have we intend to make to the bill as of right now, with a few additional changes that I'll attempt to describe to the committee today. Very briefly, the Section 1 deals with exempting certain ski volunteers from the minimum wage. As the committee members will recall, the Bureau of Labor and Industries testified at the January 22nd hearing that they had concerns about that, the language that was in the bill at that time. Between January 22nd and today, we have worked extensively with BOLI, and we have reached agreement on language. Well, I shouldn't say agreement. They are neutral as to the language that is included under Section 1 of the amendment to HB 3632 language. That language itself is at Legislative Council right now, along with the rest of this that I'll be describing getting put into the proper format. But I believe there is written testimony from BOLI today indicating their neutrality as to the minimum wage portion of the bill. I want to thank briefly Commissioner Gardner and Elizabeth Mazzara from BOLI for working, really putting in a lot of time, and I would echo Representative Burley's comments that the Bureau of Labor and Industries and the other agencies involved here did a tremendous amount of work to work with us to reach some compromise language on this bill. Sections 2 and 3 of the bill would remain largely unchanged from the current language of the bill. We seek only to add or other non-cash remuneration in two sections of those sections, and that is at the request of SAFE, in order to bring it into conformity with the way the law currently reads. And the Department of Consumer and Business Services is aware of this change, and they've been on board with this language from the get-go. And finally, Section 5 is where it gets a little bit interesting. That's the portion of the bill that deals with the unemployment tax, and that section, we've worked very closely with the Employment Department on that. Tom Byerly and Rob Edwards, I believe, are here today. And we have run into some federal law issues, frankly, with that portion of the bill. So what you see is Section 5 on the document called Amendment to HB 3632 is going to be changed from where it stands right now. The federal law issues deal with, if we leave it the way it's worded right now, then ski areas would actually be facing a higher federal unemployment tax than they currently are subjected to under state unemployment tax. Finally, committee members, we've always intended for this to be, my clients and the other ski areas and foundations have always intended this to be a narrowly tailored bill to address to protect what has traditionally been a volunteer relationship. And we have, since concerns were raised at the prior hearing, we've worked with the state agencies to try to address their concerns, to make sure that we're not trying to bring anyone into a volunteer relationship or exempt anyone that has not traditionally been considered volunteer on the ski slopes. And with however chairman wishes to handle this.
Keep going.
Okay. Chair Schaffler and members of the committee, my name is Scott Caden. I reside at 923 Oak Street in Hood River, and I represent the Pacific Northwest Ski Areas Association, which in turn represents the interests of the Pacific Northwest Ski Area operators. Today I'm pleased to provide testimony on behalf of the Oregon State Ski Area operators, which operate 11 ski areas throughout the state. The PNSAA supports the compromised language of House Bill 3632, as Jeff has ably described. I thank Chair Schaffler and members of the committee for bringing this bill forward early in the special legislative session. I also want to thank Representative Burley for introducing the bill. I'd also at this time like to thank Mount Bachelor Ski Education Foundation and Mount Bachelor, Inc. for all the work that they've done with the various state agencies to overcome some of the hurdles that were identified on January 22nd. Regarding the matter that's before us today, the PNSA would like to reiterate a couple points and perhaps provide a couple different perspectives on some items. First, the bill language, which addresses workers' compensation, we believe treats the scope of the desired exemption in a very strategic and admirable precision. It allows for the continuation of present-day volunteer activities which promote guest safety and guest education and helps us keep our slopes as safe as humanly possible. This language covers the spectrum of ways Oregonians may wish to volunteer their time, which the ski area operators foresee evolving in the future, but certainly not growing in any appreciable way. With regard to the unemployment tax concerns, I think it's best described, the association would like to see for-profits and nonprofit organizations simply have a level playing field. Today in Oregon, there are both for-profit ski area operations and also ski areas that are owned and operated by nonprofit organizations. We have two examples of those in southern Oregon at Mount Ashland and at Warner Canyon. Access and the use of the ski area simply enables the volunteer to be in the right place and at the right time, and allows them to, it enables them to perform their volunteer duties. We believe both for-profit and non-profit organizations deserve this consideration. And further, if House Bill 3632 were to become law, the association also hopes that the Oregon Congressional delegation will acknowledge some of the difficulties that exist out there with federal legislation and help us address some of those inconsistencies. The association appreciates the compromise language, which resolves issues relating to Oregon's minimum wage. The association also prefers consistent and flexible exemption language across the workers' compensation, unemployment insurance, and minimum wage categories. In closing, the PNSAA supports the concepts as outlined in House Bill 3632, as Jeff has noted, and thanks the committee for the consideration of this legislation. Volunteerism is a common thread that we feel unites Oregonians, and we also feel it is important to recognize and support those who give their time and talent to ensure safe and comfortable experiences for our guests in the mountains. Thank you for this opportunity to submit testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe you have my testimony from the last time I was here. I just wanted to add one thing. As a 501c3...
Oh, you have to identify yourself for the record.
I'm Chuck Kenlin, with the Executive Director of the Mount Bachelor Sports Education Foundation. In 1984, Mount Bachelor Ski Area decided, they used to run the race program there. They put on the races, they coached the athletes, that they were losing money. And so a group from town and the president of the ski area at the time decided to form this 501c3, an organization that can raise money to help subsidize the costs of this activity. Hence, the Mount Bachelor Ski Education Foundation was formed at the time.
And in order for us to do that, to do what our mission is, we rely heavily on volunteers. Otherwise, the cost of this sport would just exceed most of our athletes' abilities to pay for it. That's the only thing I'd like to add.
Thanks, gentlemen. You have done a lot of work on this, and I appreciate all the things you do on behalf of them, you know, kids down there who participate in this, and I wish it was easier than it is. I'm grateful that you've gotten one department to come and say, okay, we're happy. I think you still face some serious challenges. I want you to just continue working on it. I will warn you, we have until Tuesday. Does the committee have any questions of these gentlemen? Representative?
Not of them, Mr. Chair, but just so that we're all very clear as far as the schedule, you know, could perhaps Teresa give us kind of the logistical things we need to consider. For example, are we still under 48-hour noticing or 24 hours, and how quickly can we expect to get some turnaround from LC and those types of things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, for the House, for work session, we're under what's called post and go. We still have to adhere, but we can't deviate from our standard hearing time and room because those are very strictly regimented. We have to get special permission to meet outside the dead time frames. But my understanding is from counsel, the language that was submitted and that was in front of you should be ready on Friday for us to look at. So again, it's up to you, Mr. Chair, on when to schedule the work session. But we have until the 12th to move a bill out of the committee.
Well, I would schedule it as soon as you think we have language.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, that's fine. And once again, though, we have to get this squared away. I mean, I heard $1 billion of federal money we could have lost with the original language. Guys, we're not going to do that. It isn't that because I'm against you. I'm not against you. I'm for you. But we have to make sure, as Representative Burley, and you understand, that if we overcome that with language, great. So, any further questions or comments of these gentlemen? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let me see. Tom Byerly and Rob Edwards from the Employment Department, please. If you all would just kind of spell out what our challenges are here, and if there are any known remedies at this time, I appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Tom Byerly. I'm Assistant Administrator for the Unemployment Insurance Division of the Employment Department. With me is Rob Edwards, our tax manager. We have been working diligently with Mr. Eager and Mr. Kemlin and Representative Burley on the language of the bill. We still, as it was indicated, face some challenges in the new Section 5 amendments. Whenever we get new language, I've been running it to our Department of Labor partners to make sure we're not falling out of conformity with federal law. We have achieved some language that will work in Section 5, Subsection 2 for nonprofits. We were cautioned, however, that in the new Subsection 1 of the Section 5 amendments would create a higher tax on the federal side for the for-profit ski resorts. So we are still working with Mr. Eager and others to work on that language. And that's where we're at this point. So we're still working with them, and we'll be happy to try to answer any questions that are available right now.
Any questions, Representative?
We've been working on this. I'm okay. We're moving ahead.
We were in the hall just before we came in.
Yes, I'm aware of that. Thank you. Any questions, please, gentlemen? All right. Thanks a lot, Jack.
Thank you. I really want to thank you folks again. Though we don't have a letter from them saying they're okay with this, I mean, we wouldn't be where we are today without these two gentlemen and their support.
And yes, work with them. Just as soon as we get language, imagine if we get the language Friday, people are going to have to go over it. Probably wouldn't hear it until Monday, unless people are prepared. But we could post it for Friday.
We got it early enough Friday, perhaps.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll post it for Friday. If we don't have it, then we don't do it.
And work.
Mr. Chair, if I could just say we will jump on anything we get, and our federal partners are also on standby. That sometimes can take up to 4 or 5 hours to get some feedback back. Also, if we have to go to the national office, they're in a different time zone. So, obviously, the sooner the better. We just don't want to, we would rather have it solid on this side, so it doesn't have to be amended again on the Senate side.
And you know, just because we are tight, I do not want to screw this or anything else up. We got to be real careful, everything squared away.
We are on standby and ready to go.
Very good. Thank you
very much.
Okay. Duke Shepard with AFL-CIO. I'm just going to go right straight down the line here, folks. Duke Shepard, Scott Caden, and Grover Simmons, please.
Scott's already been up.
Oh, excuse me. Okay, Duke and Grover Simmons and Chuck.
Cameron's already been up, too.
Okay, forgive me. And Charles Wiper III. Come on up, sir. Go ahead, Duke.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Duke Shepard. I'm with the AFL-CIO, and I am here to oppose the bill on our general position that we just historically oppose exemptions to minimum wage, workers' comp, things of that nature. Now, because generally I think we view carve-outs have a tendency to multiply and expand, which is why, for example, under the minimum wage section right now, you're looking at number 19 and not number 1 or number 5. Now, that said, I'm also a former chair of the State Commission on Voluntary Action and Service. So I'm not a member of the commission now, but I chaired it, and we get, at the AFL gets, and I get, that volunteerism is crucial, that not everything in the world is going to get done unless people have a chance to volunteer and do it. And truthfully, I came to the first hearing, and it looked to me like either the federal thing was going to kill it, or the folks would be able to get together and kind of work something out, because I think, as a gentleman described from Mount Bachelor, it sounds like this is traditionally volunteer work that's been done by volunteers, and we're just trying to make sure it stays legally that way. So I need to put us on the record as opposing it based on our past practice, and I'm interested to watch it evolve.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Grover, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Grover Simmons. I represent the Oregon State Elks Association. They have lodges, as you know, throughout the entire state. The association is a charitable organization. It's a 503c8 tax-exempt organization. And again, as most of you know, the Elks are involved in dozens and dozens of worthwhile projects. Their major project in Oregon is the KCI Institute at the Oregon Health University, Health Sciences University. They have a speech therapy program for deaf children up in the mountains, and summer program. There are programs for veterans and Boy Scouts, auto shows, public dances, paper drives, banquets of every description. There's a scholarship program, basketball hoop shoot program, which results in national competition and a good bit of travel there. So volunteers participate in all of these activities, and occasionally they receive something of value. Like free meals or waiver of admission prices to events and so forth. No unemployment insurance taxes are paid on any of these volunteer services. We urge the committee to allow these charitable activities to continue as they have been without imposing a government tax of any sort. It was the Bend Lodge which called this subject to my attention, and it was on the mountain near Bend where the ski incident occurred, and so that's the way I got involved. I think that the previous witness's comment really summarizes everything for me. He says volunteers are crucial, and that's where the Elks are. The Elks couldn't operate without a whole base of volunteer people for decades and decades. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, my mother-in-law, Grover, she's been a member of the Emblem Club, I believe it is, for decades and decades at your lodge up on Columbia Boulevard up in Portland.
Yes.
And we just went to the crab feed there Saturday night. So
did they take care of you?
Yes, they did. Yes, sir. Actually, you know what? We bought a ticket, and I think the beer was free, so I don't know if I had to report
uh-oh,
that.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh. I'm on record. Is the microphone on?
It was included in the purchase of the ticket. Anyway, go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is Charles Wiper III. I'm an owner-operator of Willamette Pass Ski Resort outside of Eugene, Oregon. It's a very small ski area. I want to make it clear that I do support the bill. I am in a position where I understand the emergency nature of it. I understand your short session. However, on one issue for my ski area and myself is that less than 24 hours ago did I see any language that had come our way to address the minimum wage, workers' compensation, or the employment tax issues. We did see some of the initial language that's been discussed on several occasions here already, so I won't go into that. Specifically, my concern, and I would like to just leave with the committee some supposed language that's drafted by me, but it's just for your review, and I want to keep this short. I won't read it now. I'll just leave it for you, and Legislative Council is ultimately going to do the wording. But specifically, I'd like the committee to consider that some of my concerns, so you know what they are. It's in language such as using National Ski Patrol when referring to Ski Patrol. National Ski Patrol is an organization, and I don't think it's right to have that in our actual Oregon law. Likewise, also, the word ski passes shows up in all of the language, and I don't believe ski passes is appropriate language to be in the law. So those are the basis of my concerns, and I just appreciate the committee looking into this bill. We do hope that we make it through this session. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Chairman?
I just wanted to follow up on really not a question, but, you know, Duke, I certainly appreciate where you're coming from with the AFL-CIO position. And, you know, quite frankly, I would just assume that we not have to do a carve-out like this. But the problem is, as the folks from the Employment Department have made very clear to me, that because of the Federal Unemployment Tax Act, we have to do that. That's why we've got existing carve-outs in statute already for these types of things. But I think, you know, Grover, what you pointed out, and Duke, certainly you, with your past experience with the Oregon Commission, is that this is a problem that goes way, way, way beyond just ski passes and volunteer ski patrollers and race trainers and gate setters and all this kind of stuff. I mean, every volunteer organization in this state is watching this. I've spoken with Kathleen Joy. From the commission already about this. And this is something I do want to work on for 09, is how do we deal with this broader issue of defining the employer-employee relationship so that whether you're a for-profit, non-for-profit, regardless what your purpose is, you have an understanding of when a volunteer is a volunteer versus an employee. So any help that anybody can give me, I mean, this is a huge issue to take on, and the more we get into this Federal Unemployment Tax Act, and we certainly haven't given up with our congressional delegation to try and get that amended as well. But I ask for your help here as we move forward.
I'm certain, Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, happy to be helpful in any way. We sure want to be able to make sure volunteers can continue to get T-shirts and coffee mugs for doing volunteer work. And
right.
As long as we keep the lines clear.
Mr. Chairman, I just wonder if the churches are not in the same category that the service lodges are in. Just leave you with that.
Yeah, thanks. Any further questions for these gentlemen?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I probably don't have questions for these witnesses because I didn't hear their testimony. I still do have questions about this bill, though. I'm not sure. Is this the end of the testimony?
Well, there's considerable challenges, and they've been spelled out. They're going to continue to work. We got Boley to say they're happy. The Employment Department, I think, still has some challenges, and they're going to continue to try and find something. And that's where we're at. Clearly, we're not going to pass anything out of this committee that is going to conflict with federal law.
Unemployment law.
Right.
I guess my question, maybe it's to Representative Burley or any of the witnesses, is why would an amended version of this bill still be addressing minimum wage and workers' compensation? Because I never understood when the initial problem was really unemployment insurance how minimum wage and workers' comp came into it.
Well, please, Mr. Chair. My understanding, and the attorneys in the room may correct me here, but I think the reason, Representative Rosenbaum, that we're looking at in this bill exempting from all of these is because in the statute right now, minimum wage, income tax, unemployment tax, workers' compensation all have their own sets of definitions of employee-employer relationships and those types of things. So it seems to me that if you're going to be saying that we have that a volunteer is a volunteer, you have to do that across all the different chapters of the ORS, and that's what we're trying to do in this bill by exempting it from all of those items.
And I got to tell you, when that came into the conversation, my ears perked up real
right,
fast.
Right, because has anybody been subjected to saying that they've violated the minimum wage law, for instance, in the problem that you're trying to address?
Well, not to my knowledge, Representative Rosenbaum, but I would counter that by saying it wouldn't make a lot of sense if we exempted a volunteer from unemployment tax but allowed them to be subject to all of the other taxes and minimum wage and stuff. I mean, either you're a volunteer or you're not. And it doesn't seem reasonable that you would be a volunteer only for one of those but not the others.
And I think we could talk about this probably for a lot longer than we have time to do today, but I think if there's a broader concern that a bill needs to address, that would probably better be left for when we have more time to do it. It seems like this bill might be trying to solve some problems that haven't even arisen. So.
Well, we're not going to solve it tonight. Any more specific questions to these gentlemen right here? All right, great. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
Would anyone else like to testify to this bill tonight? Not seeing no one, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3632. Anything else for the good of the order?
Mr. Chair.
Thanks.
Yes, Mr.